Record on. Okay, there we go. Right, good evening, welcome everyone. Thank you for coming. Once again, I apologize for the mix-up about the source sheets. Blina, they're next week I'll bring them so you can look at it. They'll also be. I'm sorry. Yes, exactly. And they'll also be online when I post the recording, so you can download it as well. Yes. Blinether, I will give you both. Someone wants the Zoom link. Okay. Okay. So I will. Yeah, Torah Sheval Peh, exactly. So last year, 2 weeks ago, we had probably what I would say to be the most important shiur of the series. The most important one was about Rav Lichtenstein and the Lubavitcher Rebbe's explanation of the Ramban about what changed at Matan Torah. What exactly transformed by Matan Torah? And what we said was is that we became what's known as mitzvah ve'oseh, obligated to do mitzvahs. And that wasn't just, you know, we get extra mitzvah points instead of just volunteering to do mitzvahs, but rather it fundamentally transformed our relationship with Hashem. According to Rav Lichtenstein, the language was a dialogic relationship. There was a commander and a commandee. It was a two-way street, which created a much deeper relationship. From the Kabbalistic side of things, it allowed us to break that barrier between heaven and earth. But whatever kind of language you want to use, both are rooted in the Ramban, as explained by the Ritva and Kedushin, as well as in the Ramban Sefer Emuna Ubitachon. That really changed, was a paradigm shift in the way the world interfaced with Hashem. We could now become, according to the language of the Shem Mishmuel, active partners and agents of God, essentially being an extension of God and therefore empowered to bring down holiness into this world like God did. Now, that left us with the question then, which is, well, okay, that's what changed by Matan Torah. So if that's the case, then why do we put the Avos on a pedestal, right? It's not just that they were just holy people, because there were other holy people. There was Adam, there was Shem, there was Aver, there was Mesushelach, all these biblical characters, which according to our tradition were very righteous people. And yet with the exception of Noach and Rosh Hashanah once, we really don't invoke any of those people's memories or merits to help us out. We really care about Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. We mention them time and time again in Tanakh and our Tfilas. And the question is, what sets them apart? We're also related to Adam and Noah. So why specifically do we say that because these people were special, that their uniqueness carries over in a post-Matan Torah world? So the first four shiurim in the series were establishing what paradigm shift Matan Torah created. And these next four shiurim in the series, which will be the second half, we'll discuss, okay, so what did in fact the Avos contribute in a lasting, permanent way to the Jewish people? So I say that this is probably the second most important shiur in the series, because this will lay the groundwork and in a nutshell encapsulate what the Avos contributed. In order to do that, I want to take you to rural Kentucky. Bit of an odd place. There are no Jews in this town. But as we'll see, I think that it really serves as a mashal to understand what the uniqueness of the Jewish people are, and what the uniqueness of the Avos were that was passed down to us. The Torah portion is going to be a piece from the Chidushei HaGranat. The Granat is the abbreviation for Hagon Rav Naftali Trupp. He was one of the Rosh Yeshiva of the Radin Yeshiva that was appointed by the Chafetz Chaim. There was a whole little bit of politics rabbinic politics of the Chafetz Chaim appointing him. There was already a Rosh Yeshiva there who was older, and so bringing in a new charismatic one kind of ruffled some feathers. But the Chavetz Chaim did that because he felt he needed to save the yeshiva. It's a bit of an interesting discussion for another time about how rabbinic politics functions. But I'm sorry, there's no source sheets. But Rav Naftali Trapp has a piece which is very halachic. And Rav Shlomo Fisher, who we mentioned in the first week, expands that and explains it and gives it hashkafic terms as well to really explain what the uniqueness of the Jewish people are. But before we get to that, like I said, I want to take you to Kentucky. The title of the shiur is Die Like a Man Like Your Brother Did. What? No, not bourbon. The title is Die Like a Man Like Your Brother Did. That's a quotation from a mother to her son who was involved in a family feud. The people on Zoom this week get a bonus because they get to see the source sheet. I'll share it with them. You guys can come and take a look after. Give me 1 second here. So the first source is actually an article or the cover page from the New York Times, the year 1889, October 28th. The title of the article is called The Harlan County Feud, All the Result of a Drunken Quarrel. So Harlan, Kentucky is in the southeastern part of Kentucky in a very rural area. There was no more than 1,500 people in the town at that time. And it's in a place of very small hamlets called the Cumberland Gap. It's a very, you know, I don't want to use the derogatory term of a hick town, but it's in a very, very rural, underdeveloped area. Okay, it's a hick town. So during the second half of the 19th century, from, I don't know, I think like the 1860s or no, after the Civil War. So probably the 1870s, 1880s till the very early 1900s, like 1902, 1903, there was a huge ongoing family feud that was between two families, the Howards and the Turners. They had been in the town from the very beginning. They didn't really like each other. One night in the 1870s, there was a poker game. There was a disagreement. Someone ended up dead. So then the people of that family went to the other family's house. One of them ended up dead. Then they went to the matriarch of the other family to try to make peace, and she said no. And then over the next 40 years, exactly, there was just people dying left and right. I think over a 40-year period, there were about close to 1,000 deaths in the county, not the town, but in the county. It was called Breathitt County, and so the county got the nickname Bloody Breathitt. And again, the New York Times was not the international newspaper that it is now. It was a big newspaper, but it was a New York newspaper. And so for something from rural Kentucky to go to New York, this became a really big deal because the U.S. government started getting involved in this county, not in Harlan per se, but in Breathitt County. They have what's called circuit courts, right? You have courts that in the olden days, the reason why they were called circuit courts because they didn't have a full-time judge. The judge rotated. It was a federal judge that rotated. And so there was somebody that had been accused of murder, and the judge walks in, and then in walks the defendant's father, who was described as a rather large fellow with a big mustache and two large pistols. He walks into the courtroom, grabs the judge's gavel, and says, "Court's over. We're not going to have any court session this year." And the judge was just completely scared and ran away. When he came back the next year armed with federal militia, he brought in a whole army. There was no case to be had because the son, the one who was accused of murder, had been killed by ambush by the other family. And so, again, this was not a, I'm sorry. Yeah, exactly. Justice was served. Over 10% of that population at one time, over a 40-year period, was killed in just these honor murder killings. And the question that the New York Times and historians and sociologists were trying to figure out is, what made this place unique? And as we'll see towards the end of this year, the reason why this place became so unique can perhaps help us understand the uniqueness of the Avos in a very different way. I'll just share with you this quote from, it's called Days of Darkness, The Feuds of Eastern Kentucky, Just to bring it home, this is where I got that quote from. So Will Turner, one of the people that started the feud, he was shot in the stomach and he runs home. He's dying and he's screaming in pain. And his mother says, "Stop that. Die like a man, like your brother, little Bob, did." Will stopped screaming and died. And that's exactly what happened. And so there was something that was so odd to us, but something that was so natural and instinctive about their culture. And the question is, what is it? And if we understand what was unique about their culture, then perhaps we can understand what was unique about the others. So now let's turn to the Jewish people. As we said, according to Rav Soloveitchik, according to the Rugachever, the Jew, and according to Rav Shlomo Fischer, the Jewish people became a nation by Matan Torah. So when Hashem is trying to convince the Jewish people to accept the Torah and become his nation, he encourages them in two ways. In Perek Yud Tes of Shmos, right before Matan Torah, right before the Aseres HaDibros, God gives them a pitch saying, if you accept my Torah and you become my people, things will be really great. So what exactly will be really great? He says two things. He says, V'yisem li segula mikol ha'am. You'll be the most treasured of all people on earth. And then in the next pasuk, he says, Va'atem tiyuli mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. You will be a kingdom of priests or princes and a holy nation. Those two descriptions of segula mikol ha'amim and mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh have two different connotations. So what's the connotation of the most treasured of all people? What does that connote? What's the relationship between the Jewish people and the other peoples in the world? Right. So it, on the one hand, it says, okay, we're special. But on the other hand, because it puts us, it compares us to the other people, right? You can only rank things that have something in common. So everybody's special, but we're even more special. Or everybody is part of this group of people, and we're just a special group of people. You know, it's like by Animal Farm. All animals are equal and some are more equal than others. But in a certain sense, in order to say that some are more equal than others, you have to say that there's something in common that they share. And so what the way the Sfarno explains it over there is he says that Hashem loves all of humanity more than all other aspects of creation. That's what it says in Pirkei Avos. Chaviv Adam Shenivra Bitzelem. That humanity as a whole, Jews and non-Jews alike, are the most treasured element of creation because they're created in the image of God. But the Sfarno says, God says, if you accept the Torah, I'll like you the most. And that's how the Mishnah ends. Chaviv in Yisrael, shenikru banim lamakom. That the Jewish people are even more special because they are considered to be children of God. So according to the Sfarno, what God is saying is that I like everybody. I like all people the most in creation. And if you accept the Torah, I'll like you the most of that special subgroup. You'll be the best of the best. In a certain sense, that echoes the phrase Or Lagoyim. You will be a segula mikol ha'amim. Your role will be to be a light unto the nations. You can only be a light unto the nations if you have something in common with them. You're just the elite. The next, yes. I'm sorry? Yeah, so we'll get to the Avadim part maybe a little bit later. I wouldn't call it derogatory. I would call it, it has a connotation of either not having a choice or not having a certain initiative. Meaning if you're an Avad, you have to do what the person says. So we'll get to that a little bit later. The other pasuk, though, of Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh, you'll be a holy nation of a kingdom of princes. There's no mention of other nations. It's the Jews are a unique category unto themselves. The term in academia is Jewish exceptionalism, that we are a category of existence unto ourselves. And the Kuzari really leans into this. So the Kuzari uses the old classical philosophy model of breaking down creations into four groups. We have domain, inanimate objects. We have tzomeach, plant life. We have chai, we have animal life. And we have medaber, we have human life. And so the Kuzari says, Mamlechas Kohanim v'goy kadosh means if you accept the Torah, now there'll be a fifth category called Yisrael or Yehudi, that the Jewish people are a creation unto themselves, which he says, the language that he uses is that b'inyanim miyuchadim elokiyim, that they became a godly type of people. Mamlechas Kohanim v'goy kadosh. What does that mean? He says that because we have the gift of prophecy, there were non-Jewish prophets, but very far and few between. We have the gift of prophecy. We also have the ability to connect to Hashem, and we have the ability to do mitzvot, which again, that harkens back to the avodim component a little bit. But the Kuzari says that we are a unique creation once we accepted the Torah. And so what people typically do with these two different characterizations of the Jewish people is they say that this is a machlokas, or it's a debate between, so to speak, the medieval rationalists and the medieval Kabbalists. So the rationalists say, okay, there's nothing inherently unique about the Jewish people. All of humanity is special, and the Jewish people are even more special because they have the Torah. And the more mystical side says, no, that the Jewish people were transformed into an entirely different entity. But what some people do is say that there's really no contradiction. So Rav Shlomo Fischer, who we spoke about in the first week, he, as I said, was a very interesting person that liked to integrate different streams of Jewish thought. And what he wanted to argue is that, no, these are not mutually exclusive, but rather they represent two parallel tracks of Judaism, of Kedushas Yisrael, that's the term we'll be using this year, of the sanctity of the Jewish people. There are actually two tracks of Jewish sanctity. In one regard, we're not that different from everybody else. We are an Or Lagoyim. We are Segula Mikol HaAmim. And then the other track is that, no, we are very different. We are a Mamlechas Kohanim B'Goy Kadosh. We are a category unto ourselves. And Hashem was saying, if you accept the Torah, you'll get both. You will be both. Now, this is not just like a theoretical, philosophical exercise, but actually, Rav Shlomo Fischer and the Granat say that this actually has halachic ramifications and can explain some very interesting halachic cases about conversion. So just as a disclaimer, we're going to be discussing some opinions here, which we don't necessarily paskin like. So I don't think any of you are on any based in right now that's involved in conversions or conversions of minors, which is what this will be about. I don't think anybody here is doing a pidyon haben right now, which is also what this will be about. But if you are, please do not paskin off of this shiur, because some of these positions are ones that we don't necessarily actually follow. We're using this to bring out a point. So the first Gemara, or the Granat, asks two questions. The first question is based on a case of the Gemara where a Jewish woman has a child with a non-Jewish man. The case of the Gemara is through rape, but doesn't have to be. That's just the case of the Gemara. That was what was common back then. If a Jewish woman and a non-Jewish man had a child, odds are it was through rape. There's a debate in the Gemara as to whether the child of such a union is mutar lavo bekal, is Jewish, and is allowed to marry anybody they want, or is a mamzer, or is not allowed to. So the opinion of Tosfos is that according to the ones who say that the child is allowed to marry whoever they want, right? If you're a mamzer, your pool of potential spouses in the Jewish community is very, very limited. You can either only marry another mamzer or just a few other handful of people. The opinion of Tosfos is that those who say that the child is permitted to marry whoever they want is because we actually follow the status of the Gentile father. And so the child is a Gentile. And so once they convert, they're able to marry whoever they want. They're not a mamzer. They can't marry a kohen if they're a girl, but that's what Tosfos says.
Step back.
Sure.
Jewish mother,
Yeah, yeah.
The offspring.
Yes.
Now, that offspring, according to Tosfos,
yes,
that child can marry anybody within the Jewish community.
If they convert. Right, again, we're
why would they?
Right. So you're saying, well, I thought that Judaism was matrilineal, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So like I said, this is a different opinion in the Gemara.
Same question. When did matrilineal take effect in birth to patrilineal?
So as we'll see, there is an element of patrilineal Judaism that applies even nowadays. What's the most classic example of that?
Kohanim.
Exactly. What Shevet you're from. So what Shevet you are is patrilineal.
Yeah.
Whether you're Jewish or not is matrilineal.
When did that take effect?
Well, it's a debate in the Gemara, according to Tosfos. Yeah, so according to Tosfos, it seems that it was a debate. So Tosfos is saying, according to the opinion that this kid is mutter, is permitted to marry anybody they want, he says, that's because this opinion in the Gemara holds that the child is not Jewish. And if the child converts, they're allowed to marry whoever they want.
Your mommy and daddy are non-Jewish, both going. And the kid decides, I want to marry a kid, he has to convert.
Exactly.
So there's no benefit of the fact that the mother is Jewish.
Exactly. So that's what Tosfos is saying. That's what Tosfos says. That's how Tosfos understands this Gemara. The only problem is that there's a Gemara that contradicts Tosfos. There's a Gemara that contradicts this opinion. Right. So the case is about Pidyon HaBen. So there's a case where, again, same set of circumstances. A Jewish woman, non-Jewish father, the Jewish woman is a Bas Levi. So the Jewish woman is a Levi, and the father is not Jewish. So does the kid need to have a Pidyon HaBen? So what would you say?
No.
Right. So you would say no. The Gemara says yes. So that's so that Gemara is in Bechoros.
So if the baby has to convert, then there's no Pidyon HaBen.
Exactly.
And
so
if the baby is Jewish because the mother's Jewish, then you wouldn't have Pidyon HaBen because it's about slavery.
Right. So exactly. So what you're saying is you can't have it both ways. Either you're Jewish and you're a child of a Levi, or you're not Jewish and you're not a child of a Levi. Make up your mind. You can't have it both ways. Exactly. Well, so it seems to be that according to Tosfos, you can have it both ways, and the question is why. That's question. Exactly. Right. So yes, that's the question. That's the million-dollar question, which is, how does this make sense? That's the Granat's first question. Second question is a Gemara in Yevamos, also a conversion case, but different set of circumstances. So you have a woman that's converting to Judaism, and she's pregnant. So while she's not Jewish, she's carrying twins. She converts, and then she gives birth. So there's a rule that when you convert, ger shem isgayer kekatan shenoladam, that when person converts, they are like a newborn child, and they have no biological relatives. I don't know if you ever saw this, but Conan O'Brien did a travel special where he visited Israel. And he went to a shul in Tel Aviv, I forget, one of the major shuls there. And the rabbi was trying to, you know, he made a joke that he wanted to convert to Judaism, and the rabbi was telling him about it. And he said, you know what's so special about when you convert? He said, you're like a newborn child. You can marry your sister if you want. And you know, again, he's trying to illustrate that concept of you know, that you're born again, you're a completely new person, but to an American or a non-Jew, it just comes off as weird. So Conan is like, you know, Rabbi, that you might not want to have that as like your first, you know, sales pitch to convert. He didn't get it. But it's true. Technically speaking, if you and your sister are both born and you convert, you can strictly speaking marry her. It might not be good from a genetic standpoint, might not be good from a Maharasayan standpoint, But technically speaking, you can. This case, though, is a little bit interesting because the kids, what are the status of the kids? The kids were conceived when they were not Jewish, but when they were born, they were Jewish. So the Gemara in Yevamos says, so shnei achim te'umim gerim v'chein mishuchrar. So two twin brothers that when they're already born, meaning a much more normal case, if they convert or they were slaves and they became free, and so they became full-fledged Jews, ein chayavin mishum eshes ach, are not liable for marrying their brother's wife. Meaning, so if you have two twins, they were born not Jewish and they converted to Judaism and they got married, and one of the brothers passes away, is the other brother allowed to marry the sister? You know, not about Yibam, just regular. So if they were related, you would not be allowed to do that. And so the Gemara says, as I told you, if you convert and you're both already born, you're allowed to. Now, what about our case? Haisa horasan shelo bikdusha. They were conceived when they were not Jewish. Vileidasan bikdusha, but they were born Jewish. So lo chaltsin, they do not do yibum. So if one of them dies childless, chas v'shalom, the other one is not allowed to do chalitza or yibum. So that would seem like that they're not related, right? Because if you were related, I would have to do yibum or chalitza. But chayavin mishum eshesach. But I'm not allowed to marry my dead brother's wife under other circumstances either, because she's my brother's wife. And so the Granat says this Gemara itself doesn't make any sense. Again, how do you have it both ways? Either you're Jewish or you're not Jewish. It seems like you were sort of Jewish but not really Jewish, and somehow there's this weird middle category. And in fact, that's what someone says. So the Pri Toar, which is a commentary to Shulchan Aruch, quotes from the Gon of Lisa, the Nesivus, one of the great Gedolei Hadar. He gives a very strange answer. He says, these kids, all of these kids, the twins that were conceived when they weren't Jewish but were born Jewish, and that child of the woman that was raped by a non-Jewish person, says, those kids need to convert. But after they convert, they're not called a convert. They're called a Jew from birth. They need to convert, but once they convert, they're retroactively Jewish from birth. And the Chazon Ish quotes this and he says, I don't know what this guy's talking about. This makes absolutely no sense. But that's what the Pri Toar says. So where was he coming from? Where was the Gaon of Lisa coming from? And so the Granat tries to explain where he's coming from. And Rav Shlomo Fischer expands on that idea. So Rav Shlomo Fischer and the Granat, they explain that there are really two elements to Kiddushas Yisrael. The terms that Rav Shlomo Fischer uses are geza of lineage and das and religion. So there's two components of being considered not just, you know, ethnically Jewish, but even religiously Jewish. There are two components. The first is biological lineage of being biologically, ethnically related to the Jewish people. And that is based off of the mother. That is matrilineal. The second is religion. And religion is patrilineal. So if you're a Kohen, you're only a Kohen if your father's a Kohen, not if your mother's a Kohen. If you're a Levi, you're only a Levi if your father's a Levi, theoretically. He has that famous joke about the guy that pays the rabbi a ton of money so that he could be a Kohen because his father was a Kohen. But those are two things. Now, we just usually assume, okay, that has to do with what Shevet I'm from. What the Granat and Rav Shlomo Fischer and the Pri Toar are saying is that, no, it's more than just what Shevet you're from. That actually defines your Jewish identity. And Kiddushas Yisrael has two parts. There's ethnicity and there's religion, and both of them have different tracks. Ethnicity is matrilineal and religion is patrilineal. So now here comes the interesting part. So what does conversion do? Which of those two components does conversion work on? Does conversion work on ethnicity or religion, or I guess both? What do you think? So you think both. You think both. What? Okay. So you think both. Okay, so take your pick or both. So exactly. That's very true. Yeah. That's a great connection. So the Rambam at the end of Hilchos Yovel says that anybody can join the mission of Shevet Levi if they accept the yoke of Torah upon them. And so once again, we see that Shevet and is connected to religion, which is connected to mitzvahs. So the way that the Granat explains it is that, well, what does conversion entail? Conversion entails going to the mikvah. It entails, during the time of the Beis HaMikdash, bringing the Karban. If you're a male, it entails circumcision. But the most important part is Kabbalas mitzvos, of accepting mitzvos. So the human side of conversion is just the das component. Like, if we think about converting to another religion, I don't say that my genealogy changes. I say that my relationship vis-a-vis rituals and mitzvos change. And so, strictly speaking, conversion should only work on the das, on the religion component. And even though that's only limited to religion, Hashem, in his kindness and probably how he conceived Jewish religion, said that no, there's going to be a sort of spiritual magic that happens of kikatan shanola dami, that even though what you did has absolutely nothing to do with your lineage, I'm going to unilaterally change your lineage. But that's God doing that. That's not us doing that. And that's not part of the conversion process. That's a result of our conversion. So the way the Granat and Rosh Lema Fisher are explaining it is that conversion only works on the das component. And then Hashem responds as a result of that and changes the convert's geza and changes the convert's lineage. And so, therefore, the Granat says, now we can begin to understand how we can have that weird halfway case. That's what the pre-Tohar meant. So in the case of the woman who was raped and had a child with a non-Jewish man, so what does that child have of those two components? He has the geza component. He has the Jewish ethnicity component, but he's missing the mitzvah component. And what is Geirus? What does conversion supply? Conversion supplies the mitzvah component. So the pre-Tohar says, yes, you need to convert. You need to convert for the mitzvah component. But once that happens, you weren't really a convert to begin with. You're only a convert for part of it, for the religious component. But your ethnicity component was always there. So you were always Jewish. So when it comes to relationships, like by those twins. So when it comes to the relationship, I can't marry his sister because we had the Jewish lineage. We just didn't have the Jewish mitzvah part. But I can't do Ibim and Chalitza because I don't have the Jewish mitzvah part until later. So that's how he reconciles that. And the same thing by Pidyon HaBen. The Pidyon HaBen is a little bit more of an interesting, debatable case. So the child needs to convert because they're missing the mitzvah component. But what's their ethnicity? Their ethnicity goes by the mother, and the mother was a Levi. Yeah, so because again, right, so technically speaking, you're correct that it's only on part of it. But according to the way Rav Shlomo Fischer and the Granat are explaining it, that half is the most important half from our perspective, meaning from the human. And for that child. But from the human perspective, conversion is only the religion part. The genetic transformation is God's business. And so, yeah, it's a regular conversion because those, you know, the twins and that kid, they all need to have a Kabbalah's mitzvah, which is what conversion is all about. The genetic part, God doesn't need to alter their spiritual DNA. That's essentially what the Granat is saying, that God doesn't need to alter their spiritual DNA. And because of that, we have some halachic idiosyncrasies in those particular cases. There's a whole fascinating, it's very relevant nowadays. There's a whole fascinating sugya of ger katan. So normally speaking, a person can't be forcibly converted, right? We don't believe in forced conversions. You have to convert on your own free will. The one exception is a child, right? A child does not have the requisite physiological development, maturity to be able to make that decision. But because we believe being Jewish is good for the kid, we can do it on their behalf. But when they become bar or bas mitzvah, we present them with the choice of saying, do you want to remain Jewish or do you want to retroactively undo your conversion? Sometimes a Jewish couple will adopt a non-Jewish child and they convert the child. And it doesn't have to be by bar mitzvah, but, you know, around that time, we tell the kid that you were not born Jewish. If you want, you have the opportunity to walk away from it. Some do, some don't. I don't have the statistics, but it's still very relevant nowadays. But what I want us to take away from here is that there are two components to being Jewish, and not just in like an ethnographical sense or a historical sense, from a halachic sense, from a hashgafic sense. There are two aspects to the sanctity of the Jewish people. One is lineage, one is ethnicity, and the other is religion and mitzvos. And Shlomo Fischer says those are the two things that Hashem told the Jewish people will happen by Matan Torah, when you convert, when you become Jewish. V'yisem li segula mikol ha'amim, you will be the most treasured of all people. So yeah, you'll be just like all the other people, just even more special. Your ethnicity will be elevated, but you'll just be an ethnicity just like everybody else. Yours will just be a little bit different. And then the other component is the legal, religious component of mamleches kohanim v'goy kadosh. That is a completely different category. You will be, like the Kuzari says, a fifth category of creation. And those are not mutually exclusive, as we saw. There are different halachic ramifications. And for us, the avos contributed the geza, right? We trace our lineage back to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah. What the avos contributed in that two-part equation was the geza. We got the das, we got the religion at Matan Torah, but the seeds and the roots of Jewish ethnicity we got from the avos. And that is what these next few shiurim are going to be, is okay, so now we got Jewish ethnicity, so what does that mean? So like, why do we care about that? And so to begin with, Jewish ethnicity doesn't just mean, okay, I can trace myself back to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but it actually means something. So there's a Gemara in Yevamos, which was popularized by a song about 15 years ago now by Avram Fried. Shlosha simanim yesh ba'uma. There are three signs of a Jewish person. Right? I don't know if you saw, Jimmy Kimmel once did a special in New York City called Hipster or Hasidic, which is he showed close-ups of people's beards and you had to try to guess whether the person was, they all lived in Brooklyn. So it was to show whether the guy was a Hasidic Jew or just a hipster with a beard and a hat. Sometimes it was one, sometimes it was the other. So the Gemara also has spot the Jew, but in a very different way, not by external, but by internal midos. Rachmanim, Baishanim, Gomlei Chasadim. So we're merciful, we're more modest, and we do kindness. And what's the source for kindness? Chasadim diksiv lemana shertziva esbana veesbeso to do tzedek u'mishpat. That's Hashem talking to Avram, essentially, or extolling the praises of Avram. You want to know why Avram was so great? Because he passed down to his kids the importance of doing chesed, of doing kindness. So what do we see? What does it mean to be part of the Avos? What does it mean to be connected back or to be identified with our lineage to the Avos? It means having certain midos. And Rav Tzadok says this explicitly. Rav Tzadok says that these three midos are the inheritance that we got, are the cultural legacy that we got from our forefathers. And he says, the language that he uses is mushrashim bilibam mishlosha avos, are rooted in their hearts from the three avos. And this is not just, again, not just some nice drasha fodder, but it actually has halachic ramifications. The Rambam, when he talks about looking for shidduchim of who you should marry, so you have to check out whether the family is Jewish or not. So that's what actually I'm learning in the Dayanus Kol this year. The first few simanim in Evan Ezer talks about how do you know the person is Jewish? How do you know the person comes from a Jewish family? And so strictly speaking, if there's what's called a chazaka, if the family acts Jewish and there's no reason to suspect otherwise, if we don't have any, concerns, I don't need to start, going through, five generations worth of documentation like the Rabbanut demands when you make aliyah. It's just, if the family acts Jewish and I have no reason to suspect otherwise, so I can marry the person. But the Rambam says, if I see that they are very callous or argumentative people, not just arguing, like Jews like to complain and argue, but like really that like they're just vicious, vitriolic people. You might not want to marry them anyway, but the Rambam says you can marry them, but it would be smart to check if they're Jewish. It's because afal pi karov elav hadavar ma'od lishmar velasos kol mitzvah satorah. Oh, sorry, that's a different part. Sorry. Even though, strictly speaking, you can marry them, he says, shesimana yisrael ha'uma hakdosha b'ayshanim rachmanim v'gom lechasadim. If you have callous people, halachically, strictly speaking, you don't have to worry, but they don't fit the profile of Jews. And you should think long and hard and check if they're Jewish. Yes. Yeah, you had that famous story very recently about a family that was, purported to be Jewish. They acted Jewish. They looked Jewish. Turns out that they were, some Christian sect that were intent on missionizing to Jews. Eventually the people caught wind of it. I forget exactly how. Do you remember how? Or? Yeah. Oh, this guy was an active member of the community. Like he did people, he was, he purported to be a rabbi and he did bris milas and stuff like that. His whole question of, can a non-Jewish person do bris mila? So there's a whole question about all these people, did they have to do another bris? So sometimes we don't know. So sometimes we can't tell if the person is Jewish or not, but the Rambam says, if they act like callous people, you have reason to suspect. So this is what I would say the legal ramification of this. But it doesn't explain why. Meaning just because Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were kind, why does that mean they were kind? Rav Tzadok says that it's mushrash bilibam. It's rooted in the hearts. I don't know, like my grandparents and my great-grandparents had many character traits. Some of them I have, some of them I don't have. We all have things that were like our ancestors or parents or grandparents, and some things we're not. Maybe some things we're very happy we're not like our parents or grandparents, and some things we wish we were more like them. But just because Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov had certain character traits doesn't mean necessarily that we do. So why do we say, because they were, must be that we are too, and if not, they might not be Jewish. What does that mean? So the sort of mystical explanation is given by both the Tanya and his misnagid counterpart, Rav Chaim Volozhiner, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, where they both say that the uniqueness of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov was that they were able to imprint those midos into the spiritual DNA that would persist from generation to generation. And they both quote the same example. It's very interesting. So the Tanya, we began to learn this section when we in the second class about the Avos being the Merkava, about being a chariot for God. So the Tanya says that if you just look historically, empirically, even a person who does not know much Torah, you know, the average person, contrary to popular belief, the average person in Europe didn't really know much. Many of them were illiterate. And yet, nevertheless, even if that person doesn't really fully grasp the Torah or the greatness of Hashem, they still have the interest and the strength and the will to keep every single mitzvah and to essentially give up their lives for it. They were willing to give up their lives, even though they weren't the most spiritual or intellectual people. And he says, this is an inheritance from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And the reason is because they were a Merkava, because they were a chariot for God. Essentially, they didn't think about themselves. Their sole thing, according to the way we described it from Rav Aaron Cutler, when he wrote his polemic about how we should treat the Avos, he says that if you just make them seem like ordinary special people, then you'll effectively be changing our national legacy. And the history and identity of Klal Yisrael will be forever altered. So he's not saying that about David HaMelech. He's only saying that about Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Why? Because of this. Because if they were not a Merkava, if they weren't a chariot, if they weren't solely focused on God and had no independent desires or agendas, they wouldn't have been able to pass this down. But because they were completely dedicated to God, they passed on those character traits. And so even the simplest person is willing to give up their life for Judaism, if that's the case. And he says, what's very interesting is that even if you look at the big Talmidei Chachamim, like in the Holocaust, there were plenty of big Torah scholars that were unfortunately killed. So if you would go over to one of them right before they're about to die and say, why are you giving up your life? They wouldn't give you this long-winded philosophical or legal treatise. They would just say, like, What do you mean? I can't not give up my life. I have to. Like, that's who I am. And the language that the Tanya says is ki'ilu hu davar she'efshar klal lichpar b'Hashem. It's almost impossible to deny God. It was impossible for them to deny God's existence. B'lishum tam v'tayna umana klal, without any reason. He says it was instinctive. If you look at, you know, scholarly or simple Jew alike, the desire and readiness to give up one's life is an instinct. And so, you know, the famous story from based on the Medrash from this past week's Parsha, when it says that Yitzchak smelled the reach begadav, the scent of Yitzchak's clothing. So the Medrash says, don't read it as begadav, as clothing, but of bogdav, but of his rebels. So even the bad people of the throughout Jewish history were still more righteous than other people. And so in Yaffa Eliach's book of Hasidic Tales of the Holocaust, so the Beluzhever Rebbe, who was telling that story, see, he has a famous story where he, like one of the, I don't know if it was the, I think it was one of the commanders of the camp was a Jew or a half Jew who had no interest in being Jewish and had disavowed everything. The Beluzhever Rebbe asked, you know, can you make us not work on Yom Kippur? And so he said, okay. You know, you'll clean my office. You won't have to use anything to make you violate Yom Kippur, and you can daven while you clean. So that's what happened. And while they're cleaning, while the Rebbe and his Hasidim are cleaning, the SS officers walk in with this lavish meal, and they say, "Jews, you have to eat. If not, we'll kill you." So they don't know what to do. And so this Jewish but completely unaffiliated Jew-hating commandant, he says, no, it's Yom Kippur, and we don't eat. And they shot him on the spot. And this guy, again, I don't know how many sins he did, and he did not like Jews. But when put to the test, there was no equation. It was just instinctive. So that's what the Tanya says, and we got that as an inheritance from the Avos. And Rav Chaim Volozhiner, he says the exact same thing. He comes at it from a different source, which will tie back to what we said last week. We said last week from the Ramban in Emun and Bitachon that God chose Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov not because they did mitzvos, because those were voluntary. The reason why he chose them was because they passed the 10 tests, because Avram passed the test that God set out before him. So what's the significance of the tests? Who cares? What's so special about the tests? So, okay, it shows that he's loyal. So mitzvahs can also show loyalty. So we said last week that those were like proto-mitzvahs because they began to establish a relationship. Hashem didn't always tell Avraham what to do, but it was Hashem doing stuff to Avraham and then Avraham responding. So we had a give and a take. But Rav Chaim Volozhiner, he takes it in a very different direction. He says, if you look in the fifth parak of Pirkei Avos, Avram is mentioned twice. In the third Mishnah, it says, there were 10 generations from Noach to Avram. In the second, in the next Mishnah, it says, Avram Avinu was tested with 10 tests. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner asks, why is it only called Avram Avinu by the tests? And he says, because the tests is what he passed down to us. He says, there are many character traits that a tzaddik spends a lot of time working on that become second nature to his descendants. And he says, so those 10 tests were not only just to establish Avraham's loyalty to God, but rather the language that Rav Chaim Volozhiner says is, lihiyasher haderech lefanenu, to straighten out the path for us. Hashem knew that we would also have to sacrifice and wander and have good things and bad things and have family issues and children issues and all of the things that Avram was tested with. And that would be hard for us. And so in order to make it easier, in order to give us the strength and the fortitude to do what was right and make it second nature to us, Hashem made Avraham confront those as a test. So because Avraham passed those tests, Hashem said, oh, okay, now that you passed those tests, now I know that your descendants will also be able to do that. And so the question is why? We see time and time again from all of these examples, from the halachic and the genetic and the mystical, when the Avos did something, that got passed down. So now we go back to Kentucky. So what historians and sociologists have argued for why these people were different was because where they came from. Unlike the other people in the regions who came from more farming, agrarian, or urban communities, the people from these areas came from the Scottish Highlands and from Ireland, where they were shepherds. Now, there's a big difference between farming and agrarian communities and shepherd and herding communities. And we know that from the Torah. Avram and Lot were fighting, and Lot was fighting with the people in Canaan because of land, of territory. They needed land to graze for their sheep. It's not cooperative, it's combative. When I take some, I'm taking away from the other. With farming and with urban, yeah, there's competition, but there's a certain collaborative nature to it. I need the other person. I need the other person's help. I need multiple farm hands, oftentimes it's family, but I can hire people. With the shepherd, you have one shepherd that takes care of the family flock. That's it. And so you fight for territory. You have to stand up for yourself. And so these people kept that alive even when they weren't shepherds anymore, even when they went to Harlan, Kentucky. Why? Because that had been so central to their cultural identity for generations that even when the circumstances changed, that sense of honor and combativeness was ingrained and manifested itself in different circumstances. And then a Jewish psychologist, Cohen, I don't know his first name, with another psychologist named Nesbitt, they did a very interesting study in the University of Michigan. So the University of Michigan, they invited some students to walk down a hall to this office where they were sitting. They shook hands with the guys and they did a saliva test. I'm sorry, before that, before they did any of that stuff, they showed them a scenario. Scenario is a guy, a college student and his girlfriend go to a party, and the guy finds out that someone who's hitting on his girlfriend is continuing to do it now. He's making a pass at her. And so then they asked this, you know, they asked the test subject, what would you do? And they wrote down his response, they shook his hand, and they took saliva. That was what happened by the control group. The test group, in addition to all of that, on their way down that narrow hallway to the testing room, they hired this big bouncer, this like really like, you know, like 6 foot, 300 pound bouncer from a bar that blocked their path while they were walking, cursed them out like under his breath and let them pass. They wanted to see what that confrontation would do to them. So the results were very interesting. People that came, whose ancestors came from the north, they didn't care. You know, their response was always the same. You know, they laughed it off that this guy should just help out his girlfriend and move on with life. The handshake was the same level of intensity. And in fact, their saliva test was to measure the cortisol, which was how high their adrenaline, their fight or flight instinct was. It was lower. They actually tried to suppress their anger. But the people that had Southern ancestry, and in particular from this area, it shot up when they had that confrontation with the bouncer. You know, they felt now that, you know, people needed to fight and their cortisol levels shot up. Their handshake was really firm. And they said, oh yeah, you know, Larry, this guy should, you know, beat up the other person making a pass at his girlfriend. And what was interesting though, is these people were not hillbillies, as you said, they were not hillbillies. They came from either upper class Atlanta, like their parents were like mid-level executives in Coca-Cola, or they were from the North and just had Southern ancestry. And so what Cohen and Nesbitt, those are the authors of this study, what they said is that the cultural legacy of this was so ingrained that even when all of those circumstances changed, you had like these like Gen X people going to University of Michigan, that they still had that ingrained in them and they couldn't change it. You would have to work really, really hard to alter that. And so if you want a more rational or sociological explanation, that's what the Avos did. The reason why Hashem chose Avraham was because when he was Omed, when he withstood these tests, that meant that all of those qualities of willing to sacrifice yourself, of willing to sacrifice anything for your faith, for your God, of being chesed, a baishan, and a gomel, and a rachmanim, of being merciful, kind, and modest, that was so ingrained in the Jewish people that no matter where we would go and no matter what would happen, deep down, that would always persist. And so that is a function of Kiddushas Yisrael. That provided the framework for the second, arguably more important part, the mitzvah part, the das part. But we couldn't get that. It wouldn't have any traction without the Geza, without that cultural legacy that was passed down from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. So we have 1 minute left. To close, I just want to read you. I found this study in a book called Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. It's a fascinating book. I think it's a great Musar Sefer, honestly. And it talks about the impact of what makes people and communities unique. And so he has a phrase, he has two sentences, which I think are so important and really, in a nutshell, encapsulate what the Avos did for us. Cultural legacies are powerful forces, he says. They have deep roots and long lives. They persist generation after generation, virtually intact, even as the economic and social demographic conditions that spawned them have vanished. And they play such a role in directing attitudes and behaviors that we cannot make sense of our world without them. That's what the Avos did for us. They weren't Jewish. They weren't halachically Jewish. Like Rav Chaim said, they had the halachic status of Goyim. And yet, Rav Chaim said, they were be'etzem Jewish. Their essence, the Geza, was Jewish. And that's not just, okay, we have the Jewish DNA. What it means to have Jewish DNA is that you have generation upon generation of cultural imprinting, of all of the midos, and the fortitude and faith to be somebody, to be an Or Lagoyim and accept the Torah. So over the next 3 weeks, what I want to do is essentially say, okay, so this was the what. This is what the Avos gave. The next 2-3 weeks, I want to say, okay, so now what does that actually mean for us? So what exactly do we do when we invoke the merit of the Avos? Now that they gave us this, what do we do with it? So that'll be the next few weeks. Have a great night.
Thank you.
Thank you. Have a great night.